John Fain. On radio, online and on digital. The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria. We have a gaggle of historians, a record of historians, a revision of historians, a memory of historians, an archive, oh, that's good, of historians. A Rosetta of historians, says Greg. A parchment of historians. This morning we're wondering what is the collective noun for a group of historians, because that's what's going to happen on The Conversation Hour today. Tom Griffiths is from the ANU. He's written a book about historians and the art of time travel, as he thinks historians actually are, just time travellers. Jim Grossman is here. He's from the United States of America. He's the head of their historical association, and Jim Grossman is joining us shortly. So who better to be my co-host than our very own Claire Wright? From La Trobe University, she is not only an eminent historian and successful prize-winning author here, but also the manager of the under-12s, was it? I can't remember anymore. Claire Wright, good morning to you.
Hello. I'm just glad none of the listeners called in and said a bore of historians.
Is it the under-12 girls
it's
footy club?
It's the Fitzroy Junior Football Club under-12 girls. My son is also in the Colts, that's the under-17s, but right. it's the under-12 girls that are really taking up all of our imagination at the moment.
And on the weekend, the score was...
The girls, I'm. Thank you for taking an interest in my daughter's sport. It's very kind of you. The score was 108-0 Fitzroy's way. It was a drubbing.
Who did they play?
They played Templestowe.
And beat them 112-0.
And it was glorious.
No, it's not. No.
It was.
You want the other team to score.
Well, actually, by the last quarter, we were all barracking for the other team to at least get a point through, because our girls have been on that side of the drubbing as well. When actually you do get the score, it goes through the sticks, and the elation on the benches is just something to behold.
But if it's just one way of traffic and just a procession one in one direction only, it's not a very satisfying game, is it?
Oh, no, it's marvellous. The girls loved it. Smashed them, and you should see how happy they are. What do you think they're just going to – they're not competitive because they're girls?
No, not because they're girls. It's the same when I was coaching kids, and they were mixed kids in the really little hockey, and then they were boys when they were growing up. And you wanted it to be a tussle where you really earned the win rather than just kind of walloping another team who were hopeless.
Oh, no, these girls weren't hopeless. That's what was fantastic about it. Our girls were just really competitive. Particularly the ruck clash between the two big girls. And what's extraordinary about under-12s is you get real disparities in height and weight and body shapes at that age.
You can. Yeah. Kids who have had their growth spurts and kids who haven't. Yeah.
That's right. So there are girls that are, well, I'm not much of a yardstick, but, you know, quite considerably taller than me.
You're kind of rover size.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. And then down to sort of knee-high girls.
Can be really, you know, they can whip around, and sometimes the big kids are a bit slow and lumbering.
They are. It's pretty funny, though, when the girls go into tackle and one of the big girls is, you know, going up against one of the really tiny ones. And, you know, nobody wants to hurt anybody. But, they're fierce. They're fierce tacklers, the Fitzroy girls, too.
Of course they are.
But this ruck clash was really something to behold. It was very competitive, and they tussled all day, and our girl just beat her man.
How are the oranges? Still have oranges at halftime?
We certainly do. In fact, there was an email that came out during the week about how the oranges should be correctly cut. They were not to be cut in quarters. They were to be cut in thirds.
Excuse me?
You know, these are the things that take up... Yeah, it was either talk about how boring the election campaign had been and then how long and drawn out the result was, or talk about how many pieces of oranges.
How do you cut an orange into a third?
Well, you cut it in half and then you cut the halves into thirds. So I guess it's actually sixths.
Sorry.
Yes, not eighths.
Okay, now next thing, this is going to sound like Lilliput, and whether you in fact cut your boiled egg on the pointy end or the round end, do you cut them across or down?
Oh, well, there was a directive about that as well. But you see, I'm...
A directive?
Yeah, and I forget what it was. I didn't actually read it very properly because I'm team photographer, so I get let off snakes and oranges duty.
Someone actually decided to issue a directive on how to cut the oranges.
It's very serious business,
no,
junior,
it's not.
Junior football.
It's rubbish. People need, they've got to have something else going in their lives, surely. That is just unbelievable.
Yeah, I was a bit bemused when that one came around.
Did anyone write back and say, for goodness sake, just worry about something else?
No, there was a bit of snickering, but everybody's very excited.
Hang on. Fitzroy, you'd want organic oranges probably, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I know. We are in the bubble, aren't we, down there?
Yeah.
You know, I heard a great expression the other day for Bell Street. You know, there's been Sobo and Nobo.
Nobo, north of Bell
north
Street,
of Bell,
south
and south
of Bell.
No, yep. Apparently Bell, after this election and particularly what happened in Batman with Alex Batal not getting up for the Greens, although she came very close, Bell Street is now known as the hipster-proof fence.
Yep. It's also known as the goat's cheese belt.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, south of Bell Street is the goat's cheese belt.
As in like the bagel belt?
Yeah,
is
but
it
as
referring
in
to the
supermarkets south of Bell Street all stock goat's cheese and it sells lots, but north of Bell Street they don't even bother stocking it.
Yeah, except that the Preston Market is north of Bell Street, so there's an exception there. Although the Preston Market is getting a reboot at the moment. The
is
old
it?
Bingo Hall
yeah.
is being redeveloped
yeah.
into a craft beer hall and an upmarket food stall. There's going to be live music and it's all happening up there north of Bell.
North of Bell, Nobo.
Nobo.
No Bell.
No Bell. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, rightio. Okay, we'll have to go and check it out. Because Dandenong Market, we were out there a few weeks ago, and that was fabulous. It's really, really well-developed, well-redeveloped from years ago. It would have been, I don't know, 25 years since I was at the Dandenong Market. In fact, more, 35 years.
It's tricky.
We used to go there occasionally when it was in a student house when I was at university, and we used to go out there sometimes for the shopping, but it wasn't much chop.
It's tricky, these market redevelopments, don't you reckon? Because some of them, I'm thinking maybe Moonee Ponds and even Paran Market, they lose a lot of their local colour and flavour and the reason people go to markets in the first place, which is to, you know, be close to stallholders and have a bit of that sort of, you know, the grunge of the streets and the marketplace where people get together and they become, if they become too zhuzhy and too gentrified, then they actually lose some of their flavour. And people are worried about that about Preston Market at the moment. Because
because you don't want to turn it into Paran Market, which I think has just been anaesthetised. You been there at all?
I haven't been there for years, but this is what I've heard, is that it's quite monocultural and anaesthetised is an interesting word for it. Sanitised is another one that I've heard too.
It's all been primped and pimped and polished within an inch of its life.
And then the rents go up for the stallholders, and then so only the ones that are selling the, you know, the really kind of elite end of stall holding. So you lose a lot of those little...
Lose its character.
Yep.
Excellent. And historians sort of things, as academics on, you've got no students at the moment, they're all on holidays?
It has been academic break.
Okay.
I'm 100% research scholar anyway, so I don't do teaching, but...
What, at all?
At all. I do guest lecturing and I supervise grad students, but I have no teaching duties because I have an Australian Research Council funded position at La Trobe. It is known as the pot of gold at the end of the academic rainbow, what I have.
What a privilege.
It's quite delightful.
Do you get off committees and things as well? Because that's the other thing.
Well,
everyone you talk to who works in a university, they all say how much they hate all the administration.
Look, I could get off the administration, but actually most academic departments are working on such shoestring staff now that you feel like a bit of a goose if you're letting your colleagues down if you don't shoulder a bit of the load, even though technically you don't have to. It does actually
bang your head against the academic registrar's wall.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not good for morale, and that if too few people are doing too much work, and there's a lot of work and there's not a lot of people to go around to do it, so you know, you do what needs to be done. Although I have been told that's a gendered thing and that women step in to female academics step in to take on those extra housekeeping, the bureaucratic housekeeping, more than some of our male colleagues.
Bell Street called the Tofu Curtain.
Haven't heard that one either.
The Great Wall of Quinoa.
People are enjoying this, aren't they?
Get over your inner city cells. Dandy Market's great food. None of your inner city wannabe stuff. There you go.
Well, it's very interesting that Preston is considered inner city now. Yeah, it's it was not so long ago that it was very outre to live in the wilds of Preston.
Yeah, and then there's all your farmers' markets.
Yeah, there's a few of those around, aren't they?
Yeah, a bit sceptical. Claire Wright from the La Trobe University School, where they teach history, winner of the Stella Prize for the book The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, is my co-host. And Dr. Claire is to be joined shortly by Dr. Jim. Jim Grossman is the executive director, the boss of the American Historical Association. He's over here for a lecture tour. And together with Jim and Tom Griffiths, who's from ANU, who's written a book about time travel. He thinks historians are really just practitioners of the art of time travel. They're our guests on The Conversation Hour today.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Jim Grossman is our first guest, American Historical Association Executive Director. He's here for the Royal Historical Society of Victoria. He's an expert in a whole lot of things to do with American history, the work of Confederate monuments, for instance, but it's about history as history. History is storytelling that brings Jim to our studio. Jim, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tell me about the slaughter rule.
Ah, yes. I was saying that with the story that Claire told earlier about the game of footy would not happen in the United States. Where I coached my daughter's soccer team for 12 years, and they have a slaughter rule. If the game reaches a certain point, the referee decides that one team's self-esteem is in danger and declares the game to be at an end, which I recall was probably 12-0 in youth soccer.
Yes, we're all worrying about the precious self-esteem of our young people these days. I should just say there have been many times that my daughter's team has been on the receiving end of such a drubbing.
And how's their self-esteem?
And they have to get out there the next week. I think it breeds resilience. Isn't that the other side of the coin?
Yes, it is. It is.
Speaking of which, Confederate monuments would breed. The Confederate side had to get some resilience too. No one called time there, did they?
No, but then again, when you are fighting for a cause, resilience probably gets a little bit resilience is a little easier. One of the interesting things, of course, is that when we look at war monuments, we don't think about the cause. Usually we think about heroism, and that's a bit of a problem, is the argument that I would make.
So, Jim, you're making this argument. You're giving the Balin Lecture, which is the La Trobe University's annual lecture in North American History, right, which is on at the Royal Historical Society tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. It's a free public lecture, and you're talking about how we celebrate and commemorate history, in particular the work of Confederate monuments in the United States. But it's something that we're very interested in here as well, and I'd say the kind of the parallel would be our Anzac monuments. Have you looked at the way that Australians commemorate their dead?
I went to the Anzac monument in Sydney. And one of the things I was struck by there, not by way of criticism, merely description, is that it's a monument to the sacrifice of soldiers during World War I, mm-hmm, originally, and then there were things added for later wars. At no point do you actually find out what the soldiers were fighting for, which is what I find fascinating. And in the case of World War I, that might be less controversial. I think in the United States actually was fairly controversial. For the American Civil War, it's extremely controversial, the notion that you would celebrate someone for their valor and heroism and somehow leave aside the notion that the valor and heroism was in the service of the ability to own other human beings.
But it was for king and country is the slogan.
Yes. And what does that mean?
Well, we don't really care. We just take it at face value. And Australia in particular, in World War One in particular, we weren't fighting for anything to do with us as us. We were fighting for our role in the empire.
It's a very interesting point that Jim raises, and sometimes it takes an outsider, if I can call you that, to show that, because what these monuments do is that they memorialise, but actually what you're saying is what do they memorialise? Because that notion has been very flexible, and then it becomes quite politically flexible. Our students these days, our kids, my daughter came home from school at Anzac Day and said, the soldiers were fighting for our freedom. And what does that mean?
During World War One. That's very interesting.
Well, and every war ever since, too.
Every war ever since. And arguably during World War One, what they were fighting for. Again, without being excessively partisan on either side, what they were fighting for had something to do with European empire. That was pretty much what the war was about. And in the United States, that actually occasioned a fair amount of protest against participation. But in the case of the American Civil War, it's especially interesting because there the war was actually a civil war. It was basically to fight on one side was to commit treason, which is the case in every revolution, right? I mean, the only difference between revolution and treason is a matter of winning. And so this notion that it doesn't matter what someone's fighting for, you can take that to an extreme in thinking about, say, World War II. If you had a heroic Nazi, does that person deserve, in essence, a monument because of that individual's heroism, that individual's personal valor, whereas we all know that what they were fighting for was horrific? So this notion of does it matter, is it the heroism and the valor and the loyalty that you're celebrating, or is it the participation in some kind of virtuous enterprise that you're celebrating?
And Jim, how do these critical questions play out in America these days in terms of monuments and memorializing?
Well, in the United States, the reason this is a critical issue now, in a lot of ways, is issues that have been raised about the ways in which monuments to the Confederacy, monuments to Confederate heroes, relate to contemporary race relations. And this was brought to the fore, obviously, in Charleston 2 years ago when the white guy who killed 9 people in a black church had been photographed earlier and basically was a Confederate flag waver. And the question became
– 2 years ago already?
I think it's 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
okay,
2 years
sorry.
Ago.
Yep.
And the question becomes, do symbols like this, do symbols that in essence celebrate white supremacy – do those then, in essence, encourage people then to participate in movements for white supremacy, which may or may not become violent? But also, do symbols of racism legitimate racism? If in front of every courthouse, county courthouse in the South, or virtually every county courthouse in the South, you have a monument to a Confederate soldier. In other words, a monument to a soldier who was committing treason on behalf of the right to own other human beings in a racially based system, is that in essence legitimating racism? Is that saying, well, it's okay, these people are heroic figures and the cause that they were fighting for was legitimate? Or if you take these away, are you erasing history? It's a very difficult question.
And the Australian equivalent, Claire, would be the fact that this land was taken from the Indigenous owners of it through conquest and massacre, and we've never acknowledged that legally or constitutionally, and we don't, we in fact memorialise the killers
and
as,
a huge
as our
argument,
great pioneers.
A huge argument playing out at the War Memorial where you said you were in Canberra, Jim, about whether the War Memorial is the place to recognise the frontier wars. The War Memorial says it's not. The fact that there were Aboriginal people fighting for their land, whether we call them freedom fighters as well, defending their turf, whether these were territorial wars, they lost lives, they shed blood.
They lost the war.
They lost the war. In that sense, they had to cede their territory, which they would still consider is their territory. They never actually formally, there was no treaty, nothing was signed to say that they ever have handed over sovereignty to their lands. But the director of the War Memorial said this is not the place to tell those stories.
That's a more complicated issue in many ways. And the reason is that traditionally, winners get to call the shots. Winners get to build the memorials. Where that's different in the United States is that the memorials I'm describing are the losers' memorials. That's what's different. That's what's unusual. Whatever is right or wrong in the context you're describing, what's being done is the standard mode of operation, which is whoever wins gets to build the memorials.
Our great foundation myth of Gallipoli in World War I, we lost that.
Yes.
And yet we seem to expect that the Turks on that land, which is theirs, which they were defending and we were invading, that they will allow us to establish some sort of memorial to people who were trying to invade their land. And we get quite indignant, and I've never understood quite why.
I imagine they get quite indignant as well.
They're incredibly generous towards us about it. And even though this was the story of the foundation of the modern state of Turkey out of the ruins of the Ottoman Empire, they're incredibly generous.
Well, this is actually, that generosity is not surprising in a way. One of the ways in which reconciliation has been possible in many cases, and there are victims of reconciliation in a sense, I don't mean reconciliation in the sense we think of South Africa, is that opposing sides in a war, if both sides' military establishments and soldiers agree that both sides were valorous and both sides were brave and both sides were loyal, and again, the cause gets put to the side because what matters is valorous men fighting one another, then the Turks and the Australians can agree that at Gallipoli, everybody was honorable.
And that's what has happened,
yes,
is that we've extended the roll call of who we will celebrate and valorize as Anzacs. So now we look at black Anzacs, you know, indigenous people who fought as soldiers, and Jewish Anzacs and female Anzacs. And who still gets left out of this story were people who, say, were the ones who were on the home front at the time who actually were fighting for freedom, the people who were the anti-war campaigners, because, you know, there was a lot of opposition to the war in Australia as well, people who were fighting for freedom of the press against oppressive censorship legislation that came in during the war. And so some of our debates are about how to valorize, to remember those people who actually are the ones who have been left out of the story entirely.
So contrast the way the Japanese nation has dealt with being defeated in World War II with the way the German people and nation have dealt with being defeated in World War II. So the German people went through a massive process, as you said before, of reconciliation and restitution and apologies and regret and education of the next multiple generations as part of their core school curriculum. And the Japanese have not. And in fact, gone through a completely different process, controversially in my view.
Well, they're doing well for a while, and then they recently reversed.
And there's a surge in nationalism now and an attempt to rearm in Japan, whereas Germany's taken a completely different path.
Germany has, and one could argue it's possible that one reason this is possible, especially now, is that Germany has in fact once again become a major world power, in which case it's easier in essence to be charitable. But I also think that the Germans were unusual in the extent to which they faced their own culpability. But even there, you know, I came back the first time I went to Germany, I came back impressed in the same way you were. And I was talking about how especially I was struck by a museum that I was at where they made it clear that people didn't just die in concentration camps. It wasn't a passive process, that there was a subject there, that they had been murdered. And a friend of mine I was talking to about this, who happens to be a philosopher and therefore smarter than I am, said to me, did they say they were killing Jews or did they say they were killing Germans? And I said, well, it was Jews. They said they were killing Jews. It was measuring up to their culpability. And he said, they were killing their own people. Did you see anything where they said they were killing their own people? And I thought that I was really struck by that.
It was always about the other.
It was always about the other. And in the United States, we have this same issue. In terms of thinking about American slavery, for example. By the time we're in the second, third generation of Africans, we were not enslaving some other people. We were enslaving our own people. And I think in Australia, you would have in some ways the same issue. At what point does the Aboriginal population, in essence, become Australian? At which case, then, this is something you are doing to your own people. It's a difficult question.
Well, we certainly now call them the first Australians. They were the Indigenous Australians.
In that case, yes. Then the relationship is not between self and other. The relationship is, in essence, within the family. And then it becomes more complex.
So, Jim, what's the answer to that question that you posed earlier about the Confederate monuments? Is the answer to take them down? Is the answer greater education so people understand the history?
Damned if I know. I think it's a very complex question. There are some of us who would say if you want to take anything down, and on college campuses, as some of your listeners might know, in the United States and college campuses, there are arguments about the naming of buildings and the naming of schools after people who are less than admirable in certain ways. You could say, can you draw a line? Can you say, well, anybody who falls on this side of the line? Well, how do you draw that line? I mean, there's a big fight at Princeton over Woodrow Wilson, president of the United States, president of Princeton, also infamously a racist. Would you start taking Woodrow Wilson's name off of everything despite all of the positive things he accomplished? And so what some of us have suggested is that if there is a line, you could draw that line at the point of someone who committed treason on behalf of the right to own other human beings. That's a line. What that would mean is many famous defenders of slavery, actually, their monuments could stand because they died in time to not participate in the Civil War. John C. Calhoun, for example. That's a defensible line, one could argue. It would mean that the statues of the president of the Confederacy would disappear. There are some places where they've answered the question by removing some of the monuments to a museum, which is what makes sense. Because after all, these monuments are part of our history. You don't get rid of them. You put them someplace so that people can look at them and see, well, this is what was built at a certain time. The other strategy is to contextualize, is to say, okay, there's this monument in front of this courthouse in such and such county, Mississippi. We're going to build a counter monument. The problem there is that usually the monument that speaks to the original one is from the civil rights movement, which is a good thing. But there's almost a suggestion there that the first 80 years of post-Civil War history, the first fourscore, belongs to the white people, and the next fourscore belongs to black people. And you've got separate but equal again. I would love to see, for example, statues of people who were lynched. That's much more controversial.
Well, let's use that as a launching point when our next guest, Tom Griffiths, joins us. He's the Hancock Professor of History from the ANU. He's written a book called The Art of Time Travel, which is in many ways a love letter to the very historians that Tom Griffiths has been shaped by himself. Tom, congratulations to you.
Thank you, John.
You say it's a highly creative act, writing history. It's not supposed to be creative. You're not supposed to be creating history, damn it.
That's exactly the issue I'm interested in exploring, that often it does require an act of the imagination because truth is stranger than fiction. And I've used the metaphor of time travel because really, it's a difficult thing, historical thinking. You have to work against the grain of your culture. It's like a gravity-defying act to let the present go and go back into that past moment and to see it in its full independent integrity. But then, and this is just as vital, then to be able to return to your present, a present that you have to know so well that you can actually comment in a discerning way to it about the past that you've just visited.
Okay, so
it's both.
If we slip a little bit, in fact, what you're saying is historians make things up.
No, I don't think historians make things up.
Well, if it's a creative process, you're making things up.
Or you could argue historians make sense of things. And to make sense of things, you have to be sufficiently creative to write a story. So that the metaphor I would use is that a historian opens a closet door. There's a huge pile of crap in that closet.
Have you been to our place?
And what the historian does is organizes that crap, makes a story out of it, and makes a story that actually has an argument to it. And that's a creative process.
Tom, it's a gorgeous book. Congratulations. It's an absolute treat people have waiting for them. Whether they think they're interested in history or not, it's just so beautifully written that they will want to read it. But one of the things I think points you make very strongly is that history is a discipline. And that's what makes it different from, say, fiction writing, that there are rules that historians play by. What are some of those rules?
Yes, well, I think you're right, Claire. I'm trying to explain in the book what that discipline is that enables one to to find as close as one can to the truth of past action. And one of the things that historians are very loyal to is, of course, context. Context that meaning is always contextual. And that's why you have to be able to let your present go to, and why you have to allow that the past in the past is as complex as our own present, and it had its own future. And part of time travel is going back to that moment when the past was full of future possibilities. It wasn't predetermined. Those future causes were as yet unchosen. In other words, they were like us.
So how would you distinguish between... Some people have said, have used the past and history, in essence, interchangeably. How would you distinguish between the past and history?
Well, simply, I'd see the past as everything that's happened before now, and I'd see history as an act of interpretation that is a dialogue between the past and the present. And so, John, when you talk about it making things up, way I see it is that every generation does rewrite its own history because it is a dialogue between the past and the present. So we do, as we live our own everyday experience, we see the past anew and we have different needs from it. We travel back into it with those new purposes. And so it is, in that sense, it is creative in that it's a new dialogue that is coming into being, but it's not making things up because there are rules to abide by, and that's what the discipline
is. And one of the strongest rules, and you make this very clear, is evidence. And that what historians also do is they provide evidence that can be revisited so that somebody else can go back and track the journey of discovery mm-hmm. that you have taken to come to the conclusions that you have. And they might come to different conclusions, but they will have the same evidence on which to go by. So that's part of what you do in the book as well, I think, is, you know, you've given portraits of 14 of Australia's most well-known and well-loved historians and about the way that each of those individuals have gone about their craft and how they find their evidence, which is also about what questions you ask, setting up those questions.
I think you put that really well, Claire, that evidence that you can revisit. And that's what the paraphernalia of scholarly footnotes is all about, of course. It is so that people can retrace your steps. They can test your creative act against their own and against the evidence, which is, it's got to be a transparent process. So it's vital that that track be laid down.
Well, and also it enables us, again, it goes back to the creativity. If I take all of Tom's evidence and I can tell a story that's more compelling than Tom's story based on Tom's evidence, then Tom has a problem. And so it's all about the most compelling narrative, the most compelling explanation of existing evidence. But we have our own rules. You're a former solicitor. You had rules of evidence. Those rules of evidence are different from our rules of evidence.
I would also say that as a profession, doctors say have a motto of do no harm, and historians' motto would be don't make stuff up.
That's right, yeah? Yes. And yeah. As a consequence, the public sometimes can see history as this kind of download of data preordained from the past. And so in calling the book The Art of Time Travel and talking, I guess, about the craft of history, we're trying to explain that history is creative and it is something that is often a lifetime vocation, and it does come out of this dialogue with past evidence, this combination of past evidence and present experience. And that is a creative combination. And the people that I've had the privilege of looking over the shoulders of in the book as they go about the writing of history are all engaged citizens. They're very much in their deeply felt present. And that's where their inquiries into history begin.
Tom, you also really show that history is a conversation, and it's not just a conversation with the past and a conversation with evidence and with the sources, but with each other, with other historians. You show the communities of scholarship, and some of the historians you've gone through, Greg Denning and Inga Clendinnen and Graham Davison and Geoffrey Blaney and others who have obviously had an influence on your life. How did you choose? Because clearly you can't write a portrait of every historian you've ever read or enjoyed their work. How did you choose? And are some people miffed that they got left out?
Well, I hope it begins a conversation like, you know, why isn't so-and-so in the book? Manning Clark, for example, a very influential Australian historian, appears as a minor character in A Portrait of a Novelist. That novelist was Eleanor Darke, and Eleanor Darke wrote The Timeless Land in 1941. And
I didn't know about her cave.
Yes, her cave.
Tell everyone about the cave.
Yes. So in 1937, when she began writing The Timeless Land, which is about the first 5 years of the British colonisation of Australia, she lived in Katoomba in the Blue Mountains, and she wanted to find a cave as a kind of weekender. And she and her husband Eric went looking for it and found it, and they moved in. And they
not just moved in, they domesticated the cave.
Indeed. She was soon watering pumpkins and parsnips, wasn't she? And she moved in bedding and she made a sort of little kitchen area. And it's intriguing to think that this great act of the historical imagination that she was engaged in, which was very much a leap to the other side of the frontier, 40 years ahead of historians, trying to imagine Bennelong particularly, what was his world like in the late 18th century.
And you went back to visit this with her children?
I went back to visit the cave, and it is a magnificent place. It's a great double cave, really, a great sunlit cavern where the sort of kitchen and lounge room was, and a smaller, darker cave with its own waterfall, which is where their bedroom was. And there's still some of their billies and shoes and so on that are just reverently tucked away in a little niche of the rock that remain there today. So it's a quiet place of pilgrimage.
Pretty cunning trick, you know, if you want a bush shack, just go and settle into a cave and declare it yours.
That's right. And so you
can't. No rates, no electricity, no gas, nothing.
So you can't help thinking, can you, that this was where she was spending her weekends as she's writing about Aboriginal Australia. Of course, she was a novelist. She did make things up. But she was also a very dedicated researcher. She spent months and months in the Mitchell Library. And
sort of Colin McCulloch style of historical novels, yeah.
Very deep. She imagined within the known facts.
Yeah.
Tom, you're a keen bushwalker yourself, and Eleanor Darke's cave reminds me that one of the phrases that you use to describe what an historian needs in their toolkit is a sturdy pair of boots. And you also use another expression of Inga Clendinning's at one stage that I really loved, which is that history is about muddy actualities. And so there seems to be these metaphors coming up. What's with the boots and the mud? And
well, the boots is certainly an old refrain, and it's one I do love. And it's really to persuade historians that they need to get out of the archive from time to time, put their feet on the earth, see the landscape, look for the monuments such as those that Jim was just talking about, to look for the evidence in the countryside, to talk to people, to listen, to observe, and a very active kind of scholarship. And I begin the book with a story of my own walk on along a pilgrimage route in France, where I found myself in a conversation with French people, none of whom were historians, but they wanted me to tell them who are my favourite French historians. And so we got in a conversation about French history in quite some detail. And it just shows you can learn so much by getting out on the path, on the footpath, looking around, talking to people, and often finding that history is a part of the everyday conversations. There's a great hunger for history, I think, out there.
Jim, is that the case in secondary education in the United States? Other than learning American history, do American kids learn any other history?
Sometimes it doesn't seem like they do, but actually increasingly they do. World history has become sort of the flavor of the decade. And there is more world history taught in American high schools especially in American two-year colleges. The big question, of course, is what we mean by world history, which is a difficult concept if you think about it. How do you teach someone the globe?
I got really cranky at the Smithsonian in one of the Smithsonian museums in Washington, D.C. a few years ago when we were there, and they had this great, fabulous military history exhibition and all the stuff from World Wars I and II and the Civil War, and it's all there. It's fabulous. It's just amazing. And then there's a big explanatory note that says that World War II started when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And you kind of go, well, no, only if you're an American. World War II had been underway for quite a while before the bombing of Pearl Harbor, but apparently not.
Well, the problem is that I think in most countries, history is too often seen as training for patriotism. And that's especially in the schools, in pre-collegiate history, is something that you give children in order to make them patriotic citizens. And so what you get down to is a definition of patriotism. Is the definition of patriotism intimate knowledge of your own country's founding documents and great heroes, or is patriotism becoming a useful, productive citizen who can make critical decisions when it comes time to vote in elections, which is...
I guess I'm concerned the gap between people who do care and people who don't care is getting wider and wider. We talk about the gap between people who have wealth and people who don't, and people who are educated and people who don't. The gap is, the real worry is those who care and those who don't.
Tom, you've been a professor of history at the ANU for a long time now, and you were at Monash University before that. You, in fact, supervised my master's thesis 1,000 years ago. How do you assess why students still do history? Why do they come to it? As John said, this is your love letter to other historians, and it very much reads like that. But why do you think in this, you know, we keep told that students only want to do things that they're going to get a job out of, and they're very vocationally oriented, and that all people want to do is make money. And I think we're here to say that a history route is not necessarily going to get you there. So why do people keep turning up to history courses?
I think people often have a compelling story they want to tell. They're attracted to history because it is the art of storytelling. But they, through their life experience or through their reading, are finding their way towards some story that they are passionate to tell. And they want to tell it as truthfully and in a detailed way as possible. And they come to history, particularly to postgraduate study, with that book in the making. And one of the things that we find is that history often attracts writers. They're often people who want to write a book, and they want to write a true story, and history is a very encouraging context in which they can do that and make that book better so that it reaches a wider audience. So it's the people that are attracted to history often have a passion already, a great motivation, and it comes from their own experience.
Although they might not realise what their motivation or where they are coming from is. I mean, one of the beautiful things about your book is that you contextualise each of the historians within their own backstory. I'm thinking particularly of, say, Graham Davison's chapter and talking about him being a boy from the suburbs and trying to make sense of his own experience. But he doesn't necessarily, just like your characters in history that don't realise that they're making history, they're just walking through their lives. Graham doesn't necessarily realise that those are the things that are motivating him. And what's kind of wonderful about what you've done is that you've explained these people. And I had an incident last week. I was actually grappling with an essay that I was writing, a paper for the Australian Historical Conference, which was on last week. And when I was at the height of tearing my hair out, I thought, I need Tom to come in here right now and tell me why I write the stories that I write, because right now I have not got a clue. So sometimes it takes an outsider like Jim at the War Memorial, who could tell what was missing. Sometimes it takes an outsider to see what other people do. How long does it take people to come to an understanding of why they do what they do?
Oh, it often comes late. In my own work, I'm a very intuitive thinker. So you are feeling your way in the dark for a long time in research. It's not something that is wholly rational from the beginning. And I certainly encourage my students to trust that gut instinct, to follow your curiosity and allow that passion to flow and to see where it leads you. And then it's later that you begin to rationalise the process and begin to find ways of intersecting in a sort of more explicit way with existing conversations and arguments in the discipline or in public debates. But it often begins with an intuition.
Or, to use the word you just used, curiosity. That the crucial concept here may be curiosity. That what attracts people to history is curiosity. They see something, they hear something, they read something, and a light bulb goes off that makes them ask, why? Why is it like that? And that takes them into the past.
Is that what makes historians dangerous? Is that why we have history wars here in Australia at the moment? Because historians ask questions?
Oh, I hope so. I hope historians are dangerous. I think history should make us uncomfortable. and it should be edgy, and it should be disturbing. The past should be strange, and it's something that we can't be relaxed and comfortable about.
Tom Griffiths from the ANU has written The Art of Time Travel, Historians and Their Craft. Jim Grossman is from the American Historical Association, and he's here for the Royal Historical Society Victoria's lecture tomorrow night at 6. And Claire Wright's been my co-host. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.